Yoga is the path of discrimination between the eternal and the non-eternal. When, by the process of elimination, all transitory phenomena have been analyzed and then rejected, Brahman alone remains, and the spiritual aspirant realizes through meditation his union with the impersonal aspect of the Godhead. Bhakti Yoga is the path of devotion. In this path, the worshipper merges his ego in his chosen ideal of God by cultivating intense love for him as a personal being. The majority of believers in all the great religions of the world follow Bhakti Yoga. Raja Yoga is the path of formal meditation. It is the method of concentrating the mind one-pointedly on the Supreme Reality until complete absorption is attained. This path may be followed exclusively, often by those who lead predominantly contemplative lives. But in a sense, Raja Yoga may be said to combine the other three paths, since meditation may include God-dedicated action, worship, discrimination, and concentration on the chosen ideal. Although a balanced spiritual life demands a harmonious combination of all four yogas, one or another usually predominates, depending on the temperament of the aspirant. Among the teachings of Jesus, there are many things which can be classified according to one or another of the yogas. For example, when Jesus said, "Inasmuch as ye have done it unto the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me," he was teaching in the spirit of Karma Yoga, worship of God through service of man. Discrimination between the real and the unreal and renunciation of the unreal constitute the essence of Jnana Yoga. Jesus often taught discrimination and renunciation. For instance, "Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth or rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal." And, "Ye cannot serve God and mammon." The preliminary steps of Raja Yoga, the path of meditation, include abstention from harming others, from falsehood, from theft, from incontinence and greed, and observation of purity and devotion to God. Practice of these disciplines helps to make possible one-pointed concentration of the mind, meditation, and absorption in God. Jesus advocated the practice of these same disciplines, and he himself spent a great deal of time in meditation and absorption, often retiring into solitude for this purpose. But of all the ways to union with God, Jesus emphasized most the way of devotion, reiterating the first and great commandment, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind." Jesus' teachings on devotion, like those of other avatars, range from statements in which he regarded himself as a dualist, a devotee of God, to statements in which he asserted his identity with the Godhead. In the first clause of the Lord's Prayer, which will be discussed in greater detail in the next chapter, Jesus did not describe himself directly as God, but spoke of him as another, teaching us to worship God as our Father in heaven. In numerous passages in the Gospel according to St. John, Jesus made the point that love for the Son brings us the Father's love. "If a man love me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him, and we will come unto him, and make our abode with him. For the Father himself loveth you, because ye have loved me, and have believed that I came out from God." In other passages, Jesus unequivocally declared his identity with the Father. "I and my Father are one. He that hath seen me hath seen the Father." This identity is implied in teachings on devotion such as these: "Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, No more can ye, except ye abide in me. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Many spiritual teachers have stressed the practice of devotion because it is the easiest path to God realization. In this path, the renunciation of the aspirant is entirely natural. He does not have to suppress a single one of his emotions. He only strives to intensify them and to direct them to God. In the human heart, there is the desire to love and be loved, to want the affection of a father, a mother, a friend, a sweetheart. But most of us do not recognize that this desire is really a desire for God, disguised as something else. Ultimately, in our human relationships, we feel frustrated and alone because the love we know and express on the human plane is merely an imperfect reflection of the real thing. The Upanishads tell us it is not for the sake of the wife that the wife is dear, but for the sake of the self. It is not for the sake of the husband that the husband is dear, but for the sake of the self. It is not for the sake of the children that the children are dear, but for the sake of the self. It is not for the sake of itself that anything, whatever, is esteemed, but for the sake of the self. God's love attracts us, but we misread it. To read it truly, to find fulfillment of the desire for love, is possible only when we turn our love towards God, who is love itself. This does not mean that human love is wrong and should be avoided. Through human love, such qualities as compassion and unselfishness are developed, and experiences necessary for spiritual unfoldment are gained. Human affection need not be forcibly renounced. It becomes spiritualized when it is given unselfishly, without possessiveness or bargaining for return. One who aspires to union with God must know that all the existing religious sects revere one and the same reality. The Hindu prayer says, "They call you by so many names. They divide you, as it were, by different names. Yet in each one of these you manifest your omnipotence. You reach the worshiper through any of them." God has infinite aspects and expressions. He may reveal himself to his devotee as personal or impersonal, with or without form. Therefore, the aspirant must never criticize any one of the many religious paths and practices that lead to God. But this does not mean that he can follow one divine ideal today and another tomorrow. The tender plant of spirituality must be protected until it grows into a sturdy tree. In order that the mind may become absorbed in God, the follower of bhakti yoga practices devotion to a single ideal. When love for his chosen ideal illumines his heart, the devotee will realize that it is his ideal whom others worship under different names and forms. Then he will love God in all his aspects. Many followers of the path of devotion choose a divine incarnation as their ideal, whom they adore as one with the indwelling self and the transcendent reality. To quote Swami Vivekananda, "Perfect men are instinctively worshipped as God in every country. They are the most perfect manifestations of the eternal self. That is why men worship incarnations such as Christ or Buddha. It is true that you and I, and the poorest of us, the meanest even, embody that God, even reflect that God. The vibration of light is everywhere, omnipresent. But the omnipresent God of the universe cannot be seen until he is reflected by these giant lamps of the earth, the prophets, the man-gods, the incarnations, the embodiments of God. Our scriptures say, these great children of light, who manifest the light themselves, who are light themselves, they, being worshipped, become, as it were, one with us, and we become one with them. Thus the great prophets and sons of God, being worshipped, lead mankind to freedom and perfection. They are always aware that this is their mission, and they proclaim it to all. Jesus says, "I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." Sri Krishna says, "Lay down all duties in me, your refuge. Fear no longer, for I will save you from sin and from bondage." Sri Ramakrishna says, "I am the sanctuary. Give me the power of attorney. I will release you from all bonds of karma." To take refuge in such a teacher is to take refuge in God, which means that we must center our life in Him. God's grace is already upon us, but in order that we may feel His grace, the heart must be purified. And in order that the heart may be purified, we must practice spiritual disciplines. First, wherever the unruly senses and mind wander, we must try to see the Lord. We read in one of the Vedanta scriptures, "By gathering pure food, the heart is purified." Food, here, means whatever impressions are received through the five senses. The secret of this spiritual discipline, then, is to cover everything with the presence of God. Second, we are to practice the ethical virtues taught in the scriptures, virtues such as compassion, nonviolence, and chastity. Finally, we must set aside regular hours for the exclusive practice of prayer and worship. Worship means holding the chosen ideal of Godhead before you as an object of love, and in His living presence to direct your thoughts uninterruptedly towards Him, like oil poured from one vessel to another for a long time. Prayer, in the words of St. Paul, is to be offered without ceasing. Through the practice of these disciplines, constant recollectedness of God awakens in the devotee's heart. The thought of his beloved Lord is continually in his consciousness. All cravings leave him. Only one desire remains: to love God and live in complete self-surrender to His will. This